Your dog's ready for one more block. Your knees, not so much. Time to call Joint Relief Institute. Fast, non-surgical knee pain relief. 708-888-0000.
57 years ago today, there was a two-day crime spree out in L.A. Seven people were slaughtered, and it is believed that cult leader Charles Manson was the person who masterminded it. He became the really a poster child for evil, and with his bushy hair and his swastika carved on his forehead, he has fascinated people for decades. But did Manson really mastermind these crimes? He wasn't present at the murders. Was he really trying to start a race war, which is what the prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, claimed in his book and in the prosecution? And we're here today with Buddy Day. Buddy is a person who spent a lot of time talking to Charles Manson. He is a noted best-selling author, and he's got a podcast, a fabulous podcast, Unmarked, a true crime podcast, and his book, The Last Words of Charlie Manson, and his world award-winning documentary, Charles Manson, The Final Words. Buddy, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much.
Hey, Sharon.
Good to talk to you. So for our younger listeners, and we still have some, and maybe some people who just need a little refresher on Manson 101, tell us about the crimes that were committed.
Well, Manson was essentially, I mean, he was convicted of nine murders. He was sentenced to death nine times. It was a series of murders. They all took place in 1969. The first began in June. It was all took place over the summer. The first was on July 1st, 1969, which was the murder of kind of an associate of the Manson family as part of a drug deal gone bad. And that began a chain of events that led to a series of home invasions in August, including the death of the movie star Sharon Tate. And then there was a subsequent murder of an associate, someone they thought who was a witness against them, months later, before the family left Los Angeles and was eventually arrested in Death Valley.
So tell us a little bit about Charles Manson, if you could. I know you spent time talking to him. I know you know his history. What kind of person was he, and what are some of the family background, upbringing type of facts you can tell us that might explain, of course not excuse, but explain how he became who he was?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. Books have been written on it.
Right.
Documentaries have been made about it. But essentially, I mean, the best way to understand Manson is that he was incarcerated at a very young age. He grew up in the Ohio River Basin. His family was very nomadic. He didn't quite know who his father was. His mother was in and out of prison for a litany of petty crimes. And Manson himself essentially became a pimp. And he would do all these petty crimes, traffic women across state lines, pass bad checks, things of that nature. And that all resulted in him being incarcerated for the majority of his life. By the time he was released in Los Angeles in 1967, which was the last time he was released prior to the murders, he had just been in and out of prison his whole life. So he really viewed the world through that lens of incarceration. He really saw everything in terms of segregation and all those things he kind of learned in prison. That was the best way to understand him.
And is it fair to say that he did not have any convictions for what we call violent crimes before these crimes?
That's a great question. His rap sheet, first of all, his rap sheet is a lot of it has been lost just to history, but the criminal convictions we have are long, but they're mostly nonviolent crimes. I'm struggling to think of an actual violent crime he was ever convicted of course, prior to the murders. Almost his entire criminal history is check forgery, petty theft, a lot of prostitution charges, transporting women across state lines. He had a habit of driving women from, you know, California to Oregon or vice versa or things like that. And that would get him these what we now call human trafficking charges. So there's a lot of stuff like that.
Would you say that, knowing what you know about Manson, that he hated women, or did he like women?
I think he was indifferent. I don't know. I mean, he was, I don't think he objectified women. I don't think he saw women as something other than just the opposite sex. I don't think he had a particular view towards women. I think he was most comfortable around anyone, whether they be man or woman, who he could manipulate, who he could use to his own advantage. But I don't think he had a fixation towards women specifically, like you would see in kind of a typical serial killer.
Would you say, talking to him and knowing what you know about him, that he was above average intelligence or below?
It's hard to say because he never had formal education. And this is actually something people often misunderstand about Manson. They think he's this evil kind of mastermind. He had very limited education. He was functionally illiterate. He could write to some degree, but he didn't read a lot. He didn't have those kind of grandiose, maniacal plans for everything. Everything was very immediate to him. He saw everything in terms of whatever was in front of him at any given moment. He was very mindful, if you want to use, you know, that's what we would say now. He was very mindful in that sense. But that's how he kind of survived, was learning how to manipulate situations that were directly in front of him with little thought for how they would implicate and affect other people.
Well, and that's sort of the prison mentality. You know, there's,
yeah,
you know, there's immediate gratification. There's constantly being vigilant to make sure that your personal safety is preserved. And I see prisoners that have that kind of trait all the time. Now, you and I both have been associated with some bad people. You have spent time with Mr. Manson, and I spent some time with John Wayne Gacy. And it was interesting because I watched your documentary a couple days ago, and I just saw how manipulative he was and how you noted so many things. I think there was one point maybe in your podcast you talked about how he was trying to get you to bring him a cell phone, which is counterband, of course. But what, you know, in that he thought that he just wanted to use you. I mean, was that just a pervasive piece of his personality, as it really was with Gacy?
Yeah. I imagine that he came at it from a different angle than Gacy, where Gacy was a true psychopath who was constantly bragging and trying to manipulate people. And in terms of, if I say this, you will believe it, kind of psychopathy. Manson was much more subtle in his manipulation. He would often say things like, you do what you want to do, you know, I do what I want to do. And this is things he said to the family, and many of the family members have told me this over the years, and he would say this to me as well. So if he wanted something, for example, contraband, he would say, you know what, it'd be great if you and I, we would be able to talk a lot better if I had a cell phone. He would say something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I'd say, oh, really, Charlie? Like, what, you know, I don't think you're allowed to have cell phones.
Well, it's going to be, you're going to benefit by it, not me, right?
Yeah. He'd be like, well, if I had a cell phone, it'd be, you know, we could talk. We could really talk. And then I'd say, are you saying I should get you a cell phone? And he'd say, well, I never, you know, whatever you want to do. If that's what you want, okay. Like that he was very hands off in that sense. But he'd kind of fish and then, but he'd never take any accountability. He was very if I had a cell phone, I would benefit. I'd be great. If you had one, it'd be great. So it's up to you. You do what you want to do. That's that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know, and one of the things that I noticed about his, you know, I went through some of his interviews over the years and his comments during the trial and afterwards and in your documentary, he just talks in circles. I mean, he can sound a little intelligent until you realize he didn't really say anything. Did you find that a little frustrating? Like, you're asking him a question and he says these words that are just sort of nice phrases, but that they don't mean anything.
Well, there's really two parts to that. The first part is that so much of his life has become infamous that anyone he spoke to, he expected you to understand the context, and he got frustrated if you asked him to explain. So So when he would tell you something, he would talk about the ranch. He would just say the ranch, or he'd talk about red, or he'd talk about blue. And you just had to know that the ranch meant Spawn Ranch, that red means Squeaky, that blue means Sandra Good, that, you know, he had kind of this code for everything. And he expected you to know that. So oftentimes when you're going back and watching his interviews or listening to my podcast, you're hearing him and you're thinking, like, that doesn't make any sense. And that's how I felt as well. But then going back to the conversations with a lot of context, you'd say, oh, I understand. I understand what he's talking about. So that was the first part of it. The second part of it was that Manson believed that there was essentially 12 or 13 archetypes of people, and he would tailor himself to one of those 13 archetypes. And so, again, when you're watching him be interviewed and listening to him speak, you have to consider what the context of whatever he's talking about, and also what role he's trying to play at any given time.
Buddy, was he a good musician, do you think? And tell us how his being a musician sort of played into these murders, if it did.
I mean, he was arguably a reasonable musician. He had a couple songs of the Beach Boys licensed recorded a version of one of his songs. Guns N' Roses recorded a version of one of his songs. He wasn't, you know, I think that's one of the myths about Manson, is that he's portrayed as this kind of wannabe rock star, that he had this idea in his mind that he could, you know, become the Beatles, and that when that didn't happen for him, that rejection somehow spurred the murders. That has been a kind of something that's been, in my mind, has been debunked over and over again. Manson definitely had a personal love of music. He carried a guitar around with him all the time. He talked about music, but it was more of kind of a loose folk style of music. And he really did not have any desire to do something like sign a record contract, and money just wasn't important to him. So he saw music as more of a kind of personal expression, kind of a bonding thing. It wasn't something that he ever really took that seriously, in terms of that he wanted or aspired to be a rock star or anything like that.
Got it. So now the theory that Vincent Bugliosi had for these crimes is that Charles Manson directed his cult followers to commit these crimes to start a race war. Can you explain what that theory was? And to me, and I've interviewed Bugliosi years ago, he's no longer with us, you know, it just seems so far-fetched to convince a jury that this little man, you know, with no, as you say, no education, convinced these people to go to these houses in affluent areas in L.A. and to commit the most atrocious, heinous crimes that you can imagine. What was the theory?
The helter-skelter theory, as Bugliosi put forward, and I would love to hear your experience with Bugliosi. I never had a chance to meet him. He died before I ever had a chance to meet him. I have met and interviewed Stephen Kay, his co-prosecutor, many times, and put these questions to him, because I agree that I think the helter-skelter prosecution narrative is nonsense. But as the theory as they put forward was that Manson became fixated on the Beatles White Album and became convinced that a race war was imminent in Los Angeles. And when it didn't happen, he concocted these murders as a way to inspire black people to rise up. And that would therefore cause a race war in which black people would win, and then he would be in charge of these people that he allegedly loathed, because he was allegedly racist, according to the whole theory. And then he would go and live in Death Valley or something. There was kind of this kind of supernatural, mythical portal aspect to it that would happen afterwards.
You can't even articulate it, really. I mean, you know,
I'm listening to it and I'm going, if that were
the plot of a novel, you just throw it out the window because it was so stupid, right? I mean, it makes no sense. And why did he have to create this story that was just not believable, but it was believable by the jury because they convicted him on all the murders.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of another thing. There's multiple questions here. Did Manson commit the murders? We know he didn't physically commit them, but did he order them? That's another conversation, and is he culpable for them? But in terms of helter-skelter, it's a lot of weird circumstantial evidence that really leads you nowhere. And I have had this conversation with Stephen Kay many times and said, what is the evidence for it? And he says, there was one of the allegations was he tried to hide a piece of evidence in a black neighborhood to frame black people for the murders. And when I went and looked at the historic data and pointed it out to Stephen Kay that the piece of evidence was hidden not in a black neighborhood, then the explanation was, well, he thought it was a black neighborhood. I mean, it's my point is just that none of the helter-skelter evidence holds up. And it's all just kind of a fanciful way of explaining the murder of Sharon Tate. Because the problem the prosecution had when all this took place was one of the victims was Sharon Tate, who was an incredibly famous movie star at the time, and they had to not only find out who was responsible, but they had to come up with a motive that explained why a group of hippies would break into the home of a very famous movie star and kill her in such a brutal way, and so they had to come up with a narrative that kind of would explain this outrage that the jury could buy into, because the true story wasn't that exciting. It was just drugs and misunderstandings and just indifference.
So you spoke with some of the family, I guess we're calling them, the women. Mm-hmm. So what do we know about the women now that they're, I think, Squeaky Fromm, she's out of prison, actually, and she's out of prison for trying to assassinate Gerald Ford. But what are these women saying? Do they still put him on a pedestal? Do they still profess their love for him? Or do they look back and say, what was I thinking about?
Yeah, I've talked to many kind of former members of the Manson family. They fall in all sorts of different camps. Some have completely disassociated themselves with him. Look back at that time as they look back at that and see how they were victimized in many ways. People like Diane Lake or Gypsy or others who have written books, Leslie Van Houten and others. And then there's others like Squeaky, Sandra Good, like others I've met who never have left the ranch. They think that people have mischaracterized Manson. They don't see him as culpable for the murders, and they see him as a positive force on their lives and a positive force on the lives of others, and they hold to that.
You're in this true crime space. You have many true crime works, Catching a Serial Killer, Bruce MacArthur, The Shocking Truth, and The Salvation of Ted Bentley, and many more. And you host a true crime podcast, Unmarked, and I've listened to some episodes. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. And you also have a new book coming out, which I want to talk about. But tell us what you do on your podcast. Is it all past true crime cases? Is it things that we've heard about, things we know about, or crimes that are not quite known to all of us?
It's a mixture of both. And what we're trying to do on Unmarked was, I have been producing true crime for more than a decade, almost 15, almost 20 years now, and made all these true crime series. And in talking to all these, in pitching these true crime stories to Netflix and Hulu and, Oxygen and everywhere else and everywhere in between, HBO, all these true crime documentaries that are put out are told the same way. They're told from the police perspective. And we thought it would be so much more interesting and insightful if you told the crime story from the killer's perspective, because the killer has childhood trauma, childhood mental health issues, parenting, fantasies, all these things that lead up, that create this trajectory that eventually leads to the crimes that we then become that we then want to investigate. And when you tell it from the police perspective, you kind of miss all that nuance. because the police are only looking at the crimes in terms of who's culpable, and they kind of tend to ignore all those instigating factors. So the whole point of the podcast is that we are diving into some crimes you've not heard of, and some crimes you've definitely heard of, like Ted Bundy and John Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer and all the rest. But we're telling it from the perspective of the offender to get a better understanding of what happened.
And I know you get this question, and I have gotten this question too, because I've written a book on my experience, and it's really not so much about the serial killer himself. It's really about the experience of representing someone on death row to try to save their life and trying to save the life of a truly evil human, which is an interesting story. But do you think that documentaries and books and interviews about Manson glorify the killings in any way? And how do you respond to that when people say, let it go, you know, it's in the past, you're putting him on a pedestal that he shouldn't be on?
I definitely think anyone engaging in true crime has some sort of responsibility to tell the story responsibly. I think it becomes exploitive when you start when you no longer start looking for truth, and you're just kind of creating something for the purpose of spectacle. So if you're making a horror movie, a fictional horror movie about the Manson family, I do think that's exploitive. Or a fictional horror movie about John Gacy, you know, I think that could be exploitive. I think when you're looking at it from documentary, though, when you're looking and trying to figure out, well, what factors led to this, you know, how did this happen? When you're making a good faith effort to really dig into the nuance and figure out what happened, I mean, that's just psychology. I don't think that's exploitive at all. And there really is no way to avoid these crimes in the future if you don't understand them or where they came from, where these men came from.
And, you know, it's just, it's an interesting phenomenon. We were talking about Vincent Bugliosi, and, you know, I had him on my show, and he was definitely full of himself. He was very talkative. He was very adamant that his war, his race war theory was valid. I thought his book was excellent, really well written. I'm not sure I bought into it, but I thought it was good. He was a good lawyer. But I think that what you see too with people who are associated with these killers tend to be put in a spotlight. And that, is that good or bad? I mean, Marcia Clark lost a case that I think she should have won. She got her own television show and her own $1 million book deal. Everybody associated with these kinds of cases, whether they're the lawyers, family members, to some extent, there's a spotlight. So it's kind of perverse, but it's the fascination that people have with the worst of the worst, just as we're fascinated with people who are the best of the best, right?
And what got me interested with Manson in the first place was the fact that he said he was innocent. And I thought that was incredibly interesting, just the idea that this guy who was the personification of evil, you know, would say he's innocent. And he was talking about legally innocent, not morally innocent. He never claimed he was morally innocent, but he was saying he got railroaded, and I thought that was really interesting. And then when we made our first documentary, and over the years as I've researched this case and written books about it, et cetera, there is a good argument to be made that he didn't get a fair trial, which I think is really interesting. The idea that the worst among us, you know, doesn't get treated fairly by the justice system. I think you want it to be the opposite, to kind of showcase the health of a justice system. But I thought that was really interesting. So for me, my interest in Manson wasn't about whether or not, you know, platforming him or kind of getting his message out. It was a genuine exploration of kind of this dark period in Americana.
I guess I think of this. Was there any part of him that was likable? Because when it comes to these killers, you know, they're not all, I shouldn't say they're not all bad, but they have parts of them that are very engaging. And Gacy, of course, was very affable. He was very funny. He was very intelligent. He was very connected. And, you know, there were parts of him, if you didn't know what he was capable of, you might like him a little bit. Was there that part with Manson?
Oh, absolutely. Engaging is the perfect word. He was very engaging. He spoke in riddles. He talked, he said things like, good day, brother man, you dig, you know, he talked like the 60s. He it always felt like he was explaining some higher truth to you. There wasn't a lot in those words, as you kind of mentioned, but that's how he was very talented. He's very good at framing things in a way as if you're learning a higher truth. And what I was speaking about in the podcast is just that when you meet the kind of, there's a lot of men nowadays who still follow Manson. And when you meet this kind of new group of men, you see that these are disaffected white men who think that they have learned some higher truth from speaking with Manson or writing letters to him or watching him. So he was definitely engaging in that aspect. I mean, he'd figured out what worked. In some ways, I kind of see people that followed Manson like flat earthers, and that they think they've learned some sort of secret truth that they share together. Mm. Although with flat earthers, the secret truth is that the earth is flat, supposedly. But with the Manson family, the secret truth was that everything is not real. Nothing is real. There's only you.
Can we quickly, I've got two more questions for you, but could you just quickly just tell us where they are now, the family members that are still incarcerated mm-hmm. and the ones that have been let out, where are they?
Yeah, sure. Of the family members that went to prison, Susan Atkins died in prison. She had brain cancer. She died, I believe it was 2009. Patricia Krenwinkel, who is part of all the murder parties, is still in prison. She's the longest serving inmate in California history, female inmate in California history. She has been recommended for, I can't remember if she's been recommended for parole. I believe she has been recommended for parole, and her parole has been blocked by Gavin Newsom. Leslie Van Houten, who was part of the second night of the murder parties and was convicted alongside Manson. She was one of the three singing women alongside Manson at the original trial. She was convicted of murder. Her attorney was allegedly murdered during the first trial, and then she was acquitted. And then she was retried, she wasn't acquitted. She was her conviction was vacated. Then she was retried, went to prison again. She was paroled 6 or 7 times. Gavin Newsom blocked it every time. He did not block the last one, and she was released last year. Bobby Beausoleil, similar situation. He was one of the murderers. He took part in the first killing. He's been paroled many times and he remains in prison. Gavin Newsom continues to block his release. Same for another Manson family member, Bruce Davis. And finally, the kind of leader of all the murder parties, Tex Watson, he remains incarcerated and he'll never get out and has never been recommended for parole. And Manson has died, obviously.
Buddy Day, thank you so much for joining us. And I really highly recommend, we didn't get to your book, but I'm going to it's in my queue right now. It's called Plague of Steel. It looks like a military fantasy. It looks fabulous. And maybe you'll come on and talk about that. But I highly recommend looking into his other works. Hippie Cult Leader, The Last Words of Charles Manson, and the award-winning documentary, Charles Manson, The Final Words. Thank you so much for joining us.